Luke 19:1-10, the 76th talk in a series entitled The Gospel of Luke, was presented by Jack Crabtree on September 28, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Last week we got, we're back in Luke, the Gospel of Luke. Last week we got partway into the story of Zacchaeus. Let me read that to start with. We're in chapter 19, starting with verse 1. When he had entered Jericho, he was intending to pass through it. Lo and behold, there was a man called Zacchaeus by name. He was a head tax collector, and he was rich. Now Zacchaeus was trying to see who this Jesus was, but he was unable to see because of the crowd, for he was short in stature. So running on ahead to get in front of the crowd, he went up into a sycamore tree in order that he might see him, for Jesus was about to pass by that way. Now when Jesus got to his location, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, hurry and come down, for I must stay at your house today." And he hurried and came down and was delighted to welcome him into his home. Upon seeing this, they all started to grumble, saying, "He has gone in to lodge with a sinful man." Zacchaeus stopped and said to the Lord, "Look, I will give half of my possessions to the poor, Lord, and if I have cheated anyone of anything, I will pay them back four times what I took." Then Jesus said with reference to him, "Today's salvation has come to this house, for he is indeed a son of Abraham. The Son of Man came to find and restore what has been lost." As we saw last week, the setting for this is Jesus has determined and has indicated to his disciples that he's going to go back to Jerusalem. He's going to go back to Jerusalem in order to fulfill all that the prophets have said concerning the Son of Man. This will become more relevant in a few weeks, but the expectation that sets up in the minds of most of his disciples is that he's going to go and become the king, actively reign and rule as king, kick out the Romans, and have victory finally on behalf of the Jewish people and establish the kingdom of his father David. That's their expectation. And it creates an incredible mood that we're beginning to see even now, but when we get into the very last days of Jesus, it is it's a celebrity event. I mean, Jesus is a top rock star when he goes into Jerusalem, and you see the crowds, and you see the energy, and you see the sense of expectation is very, very, very high, and that's the mood and the scene that we find in Jerusalem, in the midst of which Jesus is captured and crucified. Well, we're beginning to see that now. So we have probably hundreds of people, would be my guess, who are thronging around Jesus, in front of him, behind him. They know he's going to Jerusalem, so they're just walking down the road toward Jerusalem in front of him. And Jesus is smack dab in the middle of all that. And poor Zacchaeus is so short, he can't see Jesus. He knows of Jesus' reputation. He wants to lay eyes on him. He wants to see who this man is, but he can't see him, so he runs on down the road ahead of the crowd, climbs up into a sycamore tree overhanging the road so that he can see into the middle of the crowd as Jesus passes by. Jesus, as he passes underneath the tree, stops and says, "Zacchaeus, come down. I want to lodge with you today." And as we saw last week, the reason that's so significant is it's a real gesture on the part of Jesus to love Zacchaeus. Zacchaeus is a social pariah. He's a traitor against his own people. He's a filthy, rich, cheat, fraud, corrupt guy who has made all of his money by basically, what's the word I'm looking for? Extorting money out of the population. The poor to middle income population, and he's extorting money from them to his own benefit. So he's not real popular. You know, he's hated by the people. And as you see, they grumble when Jesus says he's going to go and lodge with him and dine with him. But That doesn't stop Jesus. Jesus reaches out to Zacchaeus. And then here's where we got to last week. Zacchaeus stopped and said to the Lord, and I think what we're supposed to understand by that is he comes down and they begin to travel to Zacchaeus' home. They haven't even got to his home. They haven't dined yet. They haven't spent any time. He hasn't shown Jesus any hospitality yet. He just stops on his way there to say to the Lord, "Look, I will give half of my possessions to the poor, Lord, and if I have cheated anyone of anything, I will pay them back four times what I took." Something about what Jesus has done has evoked a response from Zacchaeus. And I have to think, okay, backing up, first, why did Jesus stop? Why did he reach out to Zacchaeus? How did he know who Zacchaeus was and how he was going to respond here? I don't know. I imagine he knew the same reason that he knew that if Peter, you throw the net down on that side of the boat, you're going to get a boatload of fish. That whatever that communication that Jesus had with his father to be able to know things like that, he knew that God intended to do something remarkable in the heart of Zacchaeus. So Jesus is clued in by his father, presumably, you need to stop and invite him to go to dinner. So he does, and sure enough, Zacchaeus responds to the act of love by Jesus by loving back. It's a paradigm, really, of all of us. Jesus doesn't love us because we love him. We love Jesus because he loved us. We don't love God because, or God doesn't love us because we love God. We love God because God has loved us. I mean, we're always the ones responding in this relationship with our Creator. We don't naturally, normally, automatically, necessarily get it right in our relationship to the Creator. We're rebels against God. That's what is innate to every fiber of our being, is that we're in rebellion against our Creator. But as God works in our heart and affects our heart and changes our heart, then when he comes and responds in love and does something spectacularly loving toward us, those of us who belong to him respond in love to him. That's what we're seeing in Zacchaeus here. So before he even gets back to his own home, he stops and he's resolved to do something, to change. He's describing repentance here. I'm going to change course in my life. I'm not going to be the person that I have been up to now. So he makes two promises. I'm going to give half of my possessions to the poor. It's the first. And the second is, if I have cheated anyone of anything, I will pay them back four times what I took. Here's the thing. I want to stop here and think about this for a little while. How does Jesus know that this promise on the part of Zacchaeus is a genuine act of repentance? How does he know it's not just following some script? How do you know when what you're doing as an emblem of your repentance is enough? Why only half? Why only give half to the poor? The guy's stinking rich. He's not even going to feel that. Why not three quarters? Why not 90%? Why not 95%? 99%? The rich young ruler was supposed to sell everything that he had and give it to the poor. How come not 100%? That's what Jesus required of the rich young ruler. And yet here, notice how Jesus responds, "Today salvation has come to this house, for he is indeed a son of Abraham." So why is this enough on the part of Zacchaeus, if the rich young ruler would have had to have sold everything? There's another issue that's intertwined with this, and that is, how are we even supposed to understand our faith and our discipleship and following Jesus and what it means to follow Jesus? Most of us in this country have been radically impacted through the history of ideas, through socialistic ideals, Marxist ideals, the Enlightenment ideals that have come down to us, that are primarily focused on righteousness as being institutional in nature rather than personal and individual. They're institutional in nature. So evil is institutional and righteousness is institutional. So what does God want to do? He wants to come into the world and fix our institutions, make our church a righteous church, make our government a righteous government, make our economy, make this a righteous that, this a righteous that. That's fundamental. What else would he do? I mean, what other kind of righteousness is there if it's not institutional? I mean, we've all been inundated by those kinds of ideals, those kinds of values, those kinds of thinking. So we look at a passage like this and we say, yeah, see, that's what Jesus is all about. Jesus came into the world to make rich people give their money to poor people. Why else did he come into the world? So we look at a passage like this and it just, looking at it through those Marxist socialist lenses, that's the perspective that we take on something like this. This, of course, is problematic then to our lenses, because why is it enough? There's still poor people left over after he's given half of his possessions to the poor. He didn't fix it. So he should have given it all, and he should have got every other tax collector to give all their money. Is that what's going on? And I'm going to argue, no, it's not. That we have a fundamentally different paradigm here at work in the biblical worldview that is not Marxist socialist in nature. In order to understand, I think, what's going on here, I'm going to go back to the Old Testament and look at a couple of things. And what sparks this is what Jesus says. Today salvation has come to this house, for he is indeed a son of Abraham. Okay, son of Abraham, what are you talking about? Galatians, Romans, both of them talk about there are children of Abraham and then there are children of Abraham. There are those who are children of Abraham because of biological descent, but then there are those who are children of Abraham in fact, children of Abraham indeed, because, as he puts it in Romans 4, they walk in the steps of the faith of their father, Abraham. They have the same kind of faith as Abraham does. So when Jesus comments, for he is indeed a son of Abraham, undoubtedly that's what Jesus is getting at. This Zacchaeus is not just biologically descended from Abraham. This Zacchaeus is indeed a son of Abraham. He has the same faith as Abraham did. Well, when you think of the faith of Abraham, the thing that obviously comes to mind is that well-known testing of Abraham's faith when God required of him that he offer up his son Isaac on the altar. I'm going to look at that passage and another passage in the Old Testament to see what exactly is going on here. How is it that Zacchaeus is making these two promises makes him a son of Abraham? Let me find my notes, sorry. Genesis 22. Well, do I want to start there? Let's do that. Genesis 22. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. He said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, and go to the land of Moriah and offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. So Abraham rose early in the morning and saddled his donkey and took two of his young men with him and Isaac his son, and he split wood for the burnt offering and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes and saw the place from a distance. Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey, and I and the lad will go over there and we will worship and return to you. Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife, so the two of them walked on together. Isaac spoke to Abraham his father and said, my father, and he said, here I am, my son. And he said, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? Abraham said, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built the altar there and arranged the wood and bound his son Isaac and laid him on the altar on top of the wood. Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. But the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, "Abraham, Abraham." And he said, "Here I am." He said, "Do not stretch out your hand against the lad and do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me." Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by its horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. Abraham called the name of that place, "The Lord will provide," as it is said to this day, "In the mount of the Lord it will be provided." Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, "By myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gates of their enemies. In your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because you have obeyed my voice." So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abraham lived at Beersheba. Now, what I want to do is contrast that event with this other event in Exodus 32. This is an encounter with Moses, 32:7-14. This is as Moses is returning and the people of Israel at Mount Sinai have built the and worshiped the golden calf, and God's anger is burning against them. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down at once, for your people whom you brought up from the land of Egypt have corrupted themselves. They have quickly turned aside from the way which I commanded them. They have made for themselves a molten calf and have worshipped it and have sacrificed to it and said, 'This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt.' The Lord said to Moses, 'I have seen this people, and behold, they are an obstinate people. Now then let me alone, that my anger may burn against them and that I may destroy them, and I will make of you a great nation.' Then Moses entreated the Lord his God and said, 'O Lord, why does your anger burn against your people whom you have brought up from the land of Egypt with great power and with a mighty hand? Why should the Egyptians speak, saying, with evil intent, he brought them out to kill them in the mountains and to destroy them from the face of the earth? Turn from your burning anger and change your mind about doing harm to your people. Remember Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, your servants, to whom you swore by yourself and said to them, I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens, and all this land of which I have spoken, I will give to your descendants, and they shall inherit it forever.' So the Lord changed his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people." For years, I've been troubled by the contrast between that second encounter between Moses and God and the first one between Abraham and God over his son Isaac. The passage in Genesis is supposed to be a testing of Abraham's faith, a testing of his faith. It seems to me that the account in Exodus very clearly is a testing and a display of Moses' faith. It's not at all clear that what's happening in Abraham's case is a testing of his faith to me. And let me explain why. Notice how Moses reacts. Moses has been the leader who's led the people out of Egypt into Mount Sinai. Why? In order that they might finally fulfill the ancient promises that God made to Abraham. I will be a God to them, and I will be their God, and they will be my people. So instead of leaving them in slavery in Egypt, he's going to lead them out, take them to the land that has been promised to them from generations before, lead them into that land and establish a covenant relationship with them where he rules over them as their God and king, and they serve him as his people. That's why he's led them out of Egypt. So God gets angry with them because of their idolatry and making the molten calf, and comes to Moses and says, "I've got an idea. Why don't I just wipe out the whole lot of them, kill them dead, flat dead, and start over with you, and I'll make you my people." And Moses doesn't respond,
cool,
yeah, get on with it, let's do that. His response is, but God, you've made some promises. You've had some purposes that you're bringing to pass. You have a whole storyline that you said was going to unfold. What about that? I mean, you're not going to look very faithful to, as a God, very faithful to your promises if you just on a whim spontaneously change course and do something else instead. You need to remain faithful to the promises that you've already made and to the purposes that you've already set in motion. You just need to see that through. Now that, it seems to me, is a display of faith. And the reason I say faith is because Moses is demonstrating that he really believes that the God who brought them out of Egypt has fully intended to keep his word, that he fully intends to bring them into the land and become their God, and they will be his people, and so on and so forth. That he believes the story, he believes the purposes, he believes the promises that God has outlined. That's faith, is it not? So the question that's always plagued me is, so following the pattern of Moses, why didn't Abraham respond very differently? When God comes to Abraham and says, okay, Abraham, I want you to take your son, your only son, and I want you to offer him up to me on the altar, why wouldn't faith respond, God, let me remind you of a few things. I had other children and relatives who could have been the child that you promised. I had a child, Ishmael, and I asked you that you make him the child of promise. And you said to me, no, it's going to be a child from your wife, Sarah. And finally, miraculously, you gave us this son and said, this is the son I've promised you. And you promised that you were going to make me a great nation through this son, that you would multiply his descendants as the sand of the sea and the stars in the sky and all that kind of stuff. And you promised me that those are going to be the people over whom you would be their God and they would be your people. You promised me all that. There's no way that you want me to kill this child. I don't believe that you want that, because I believe the promises that you've already given me. And then have God respond the same way he did to Moses. Oh yeah, I forgot. You're right. I don't want you to kill your son. That would be very like God to do that, because in every one of the encounters that we see like this in the biblical accounts, it's God coming to us trying to provoke our faith. God doesn't forget. God's not going to change his mind. He's going to do what he's going to do. All that stuff is theater, in a sense, in his interaction with us. It's theater trying to draw out and elicit out of us a commitment from us to the purposes and promises of God. That's what he's all about. It would have been very like God to do that with Abraham. But Abraham responds very differently. Abraham's response is, want me to kill my son? Okay. All right. If you want it, I'll do it. Now, don't get me wrong. It's very clear from the account that God respects Abraham's response. But why does he respect it? I think he respects it because it's a different aspect of faith that he's displaying. The aspect of faith that Abraham is displaying is, God, everything you have told me to do has been right, appropriate, beneficial to me, a blessing to me. When I have obeyed you in the past, you have prospered me. I have learned that the right thing to do is to obey you. So if you tell me to slay my son, then I'll slay my son. Nothing wrong with that. There would be something terribly wrong with that if he didn't have good reason to know that it really was Yahweh, it really was God, and had a lifetime of experience with Yahweh, where Yahweh had shown his goodness to Abraham. I mean, we shouldn't be obeying every voice that comes along. But that's not what Abraham's doing. This is not an ignorant, stupid, delusional obedience. This is an informed, rational, grounded obedience. So he obeys. God respects that. He honors that. He does, in the end, say, "Just kidding about that Isaac thing," and they get on with their promises, with a life of fulfilling his promises to Abraham. What finally struck me in studying the Zacchaeus account, as I looked at the Moses and Abraham thing, what finally struck me is the problem most of us have, and I certainly have been affected by this, is that we expect that there's a right way to respond, that what God wants is for me to do the right thing. But I think what we see in the comparison with the Moses and the Abraham thing is it's not doing the right thing, it's being the right kind of person and having the right orientation toward God that God's looking for. Abraham could have done what Moses did, I submit, and that too would have passed the test of his faith. Abraham could have pleaded with God for the life of his son on the basis of God's own promises, and that would have demonstrated that he believed in those promises. So I think he could have responded like Moses did, and it still would have been right. It still would have been passing the test, because he was rightly oriented toward God and the things of God. That's what God is looking for. He's not looking for me doing it right and getting it right and outwardly behaving in the right kind of way. What he's looking for is my taking God and the things of God seriously. That's what makes a man or woman of faith a man or woman of faith, a man or woman of God. So that makes the problem back with Zacchaeus evaporate. Jesus isn't saying this is a true son of Abraham indeed on the basis of him getting the formula right. Four times what you cheated? Okay, that's enough. Half your possessions to the poor? Okay. 49 was the limit. You got it. He's not looking at his outward obedience. It's not what Zacchaeus promises, it's why he promises it that counts. Zacchaeus doesn't know what to do any more than we would know what to do. What am I supposed to do? Well, it's the fact that he wants to do something that makes him a son of Abraham. It's the fact that he wants to honor God that makes him a son of Abraham. It's the fact that he wants to change that makes him a son of Abraham. All of the things that we actually end up doing as disciples of Jesus are bumbling. We bumble and we make mistakes and we get it wrong and we don't perform well. We are not very graceful at being disciples of Jesus. But we're not going to be judged based on how gracefully we walk with Jesus. We're going to be judged by whether we want to walk with Jesus. And that's all Jesus has to be reading off of Zacchaeus' decision here, his promises here, is what is he doing? Why is he doing this? What does he want? He wants Jesus now to teach him. He wants to follow Jesus. He wants Jesus to be his rabbi. And he doesn't know what else to do other than, well, how about if I give half my possessions to the poor and pay back four times what I've ripped people off? The problem with the Enlightenment, socialist, Marxist, left political, social, left-wing perspective worldview is that it's not the biblical worldview. It's a radically different worldview. It's an alien worldview. And in all kinds of different ways, we Christians are way, way too out of touch with what the Bible teaches. We haven't taken the Bible seriously. All too often you read books where they take an alien worldview from the Bible. They find a dozen Bible verses that they hang on their worldview like ornaments to baptize it and say, "See, I'm a Christian too. Here's the Christian perspective on such and such." Nothing is a Christian's perspective on anything unless it is profoundly and deeply rooted in the entire biblical worldview from beginning to end. So we need to take great care. We're just way too uncritical about the ways in which people sell us their perspective and their values and their priorities and something as Christian. It's not Christian unless it's coherent and consistent with everything the Bible teaches us about God, about mankind, about the priorities, and so on. And here, the issue is, God's priority is not on transforming the world. God's priority is in reaching into this world and snatching some of us out of it. This world is evil from beginning to end, from toe to foot. Injustice is embedded in everything that we encounter in this life. We get robbed, we get cheated, we get slandered, we get lied against. Politics enters into everything and every aspect of the life. People trying to get ahead, trying to get an advantage, trying to get the best for themselves and forget you. It's not love that leads to our interaction with each other in the world. So are our institutions unjust? Yeah. You going to fix it by fixing the institution? No way. Because the same people who made that institution unjust are going to make the next institution unjust. We're just not going to escape the sorrow and the grief and the evil and the injustice of this life. We're not going to escape it as long as we live here in this world. It's just here to stay. There's no presidential candidate who's going to save us from that. I'm the problem, not policies. I'm the problem. You're the problem. They are the problem. It's the human heart that is our problem. And the only solution in the end to that is going to be when God takes us out of this world altogether and takes us to a righteous kingdom where our hearts have been changed and righteous people will live under a righteous king. That and only that can be the possible real solution to the problems that plague us in this life. So we mustn't impose that kind of paradigm and that kind of worldview on the Bible that says Jesus came into the world to fix it. And the kind of paradigm that says Jesus came into the world to change our outward behavior. He didn't come into the world to fix it, and he didn't come into the world to change our unrighteous behavior. He came into the world to snatch us out of it, and he's going to snatch us out of it by reorienting my insides to him so that I want his salvation, I want his deliverance, I want to know my God. That's the best we're going to get in this life. That's the best we're going to get here and now. So he ends this section then. And Jesus said with reference to him, today salvation has come to this house. Why? Not because of his outward behavior, but because of what that represented in terms of his heart's orientation. Today salvation has come to this house, for he is indeed a son of Abraham. The Son of Man came to find and restore what has been lost. What's that mean? I think what he means is the people of God is in shambles. The children of Abraham are not children of Abraham. But what the Son of Man came to do is to come in and find those children of Abraham in shambles and restore them to being truly children of Abraham. I don't think we're even in view here in this comment, we Gentile dogs, but that's just another story. That's just another part of the story. But he came to turn the hearts that are away from God, of the people of God, turn the hearts of those people back to God and to restore that. Okay. The next thing goes on to a parable, and I want to look at that. But why don't we pause here for any comments you want to make about Zacchaeus before we move on.
Thanks, Jack. Just a couple quick comments. You've solved the problem that I've always had with one of my heroes in the Bible, which is Lot, who never did anything right. Lot has been sort of really a hero for me because of the bumbling part and actually, on face value, never did anything, quote, acted righteously. I mean, he offered his daughters up to the guys knocking on the door, you know. But he acted out of faith, which is obvious in the paradigm that you just created. Mm-hmm. That is, he feared God more and was willing, in a wrong-minded kind of way, here, take my daughters, never mind the angel, the messenger from God. So that's one, and thanks for that. Second is, I love the story about Abraham offering up Isaac. You know, in Hebrews, it does talk a little bit about that, the fact that Abraham, in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, you know, reasoned that God could fulfill that promise that he believed in, just as you described, by bringing Isaac back from the dead, if that's
right.
What it took.
Right.
So the commitment to the promise, as you pointed out, I think, is even confirmed in that aspect of it as well.
Right.
So that's it.
Would you make one more comment? You mentioned to me something that you had noticed or observed or learned about a double.
Yeah.
Because he says Zacchaeus, is that right? You come down.
The idea that when you see, I may just be making this up, which is pretty common for me, but I remember hearing somewhere, I don't know, in looking at the notion that when a greeting is repeated, for example, Lord, Lord.
Lord, Lord, yeah.
Or when Jesus would say, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, and maybe David could comment on this, you know, and you see it in a number of places, that the idea is that that's, from the speaker's point of view, that that's a sign of kind of an internal intimacy with the object, the subject that they're speaking to. And it shows a very warm, deep relationship from the heart. Now, the part that always bothered me about that was Jesus says, many will come to me and say in that day, Lord, Lord. And then I finally got it. The thing that kind of makes that true completely in my thinking and wherever I heard this is those people that are coming to the Lord on that day, in their own minds, have an intimacy with the Lord. They actually believe, just as Jesus said, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, and he loved Jerusalem, and he had an intimacy and a warmness and a commitment to Jerusalem, just as those who say, Lord, Lord, you know, and Jesus responds, yes, you recognize that I'm the Son of Man, that they, unfortunately, have a blindness and have that sense of self-deception that they have that relationship. And, of course, Jesus goes on to say, you'll say to me, Lord, Lord, but depart from me, for I never knew you. So the idea of this repeating the greeting has, for better or for worse, that sense of intimacy. And we saw that in the story previously. I think that.
Yeah, that was it. Son of David. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that not only did he recognize that he was the son of David, but that he really did have that personal, individual, existential. Well, that's a word I learned from you. I learned many words from you. Dude was another one. Well, anyway, so thanks. I mean, that the idea of having faith expressing itself in a way that doesn't oftentimes or doesn't really seem to look like it's a righteous kind of thing to do. Hey, I'm going to go kill my son. That's what God, you know. I remember asking the first pastor I ever had, how can you do that? You know, I'll kill your son. I don't get it, you know.
Yeah.
And, I get it now, so thanks.
Thanks.
There's a theme among the rich and powerful, I think, I've detected in the biblical literature. About every time they want to seem magnanimous and big, they say, ask me anything you want, up to half my kingdom. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
The stripper dances before the king, and he's all worked up. And just ask anything you want, up to half my kingdom. And, okay, we want the head of John the Baptist. Oh, not that. You know, it's like...
I'll bet she regretted that decision.
Yeah. Well, there seems to be this tradition of up to half of everything I have as a gesture of mm-hmm. that's what I'm feeling. But this guy really is going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like a king that says, I'll give you half everything I have, but then that makes you a challenge to my throne, so I'm going to have you assassinated right after that. This guy really means it. All that, you know, Herod and all these guys who spout off, I'll give you half of anything I have. He's really, really going to get half of everything he has. And that's touching.
Mm-hmm.
That's if that's part of their culture, if that phrase is part of their culture. The other thing I noticed is he says, if I've defrauded anyone, I'll give them four times as much. In the Hebrew law, you're supposed to give five times what you stole.
I looked at that.
So is he actually saying, well, I've given their taxes to Rome. I don't have that anymore. But I'll give them four times what I defrauded them. And there's some kind of... he can't promise more than he's got a moment there, but he'll promise all that he has. Is there anything to that?
I looked at that. I don't recall that. Actually, there's different. It depends on the kind of thing that it is, how much you're supposed to restore. Some things you restore exactly the same amount that you took. Some of them it's twice as much. I don't remember five times as much. I thought it was four times as much. But in any case, this probably surpasses the law, given the kind of thing that it is. It probably surpasses the requirements of the covenant, as I recall.
In the comparison of Abraham and Moses, and in that concept, that idea of being more than doing, they were looking for a Messiah who was going to do something for them. He was going to change their society, their institution of the time, and they became very disappointed. And some decided he wasn't the Messiah. And then you talked about our culture and the relevancy of our Christianity as we play it out and live it out in our culture. And the issues that plague us as Christians, we get worried about the election, we get worried about global warming, every Christian gets worried about different things, and different ones worry about some things and others don't, and there's polarization. So how would you answer how we're supposed to be in view of those things now, in terms of activism? Or would you say just be in your faith and don't be involved?
I think the most important thing is that I really have no business passing judgment on your decisions about what to do. I guess you said what to be. Is that what you said? But I assume you're speaking loosely for what to do. At that, okay. When it comes to social and political kinds of issues, for example, there's a lot of complicated stuff that I need to make a decision about. What's the best tactic for... I mean, you and I could agree completely on what the loving thing to do, or what the most valuable thing would be to have occur in our culture, say economically, for example. We could agree on that, but we may disagree on the means to that end, because we're having to know stuff about economics that I'm inclined to think nobody knows and can know. I mean, as much as economics tries to claim that it's a science, I'm not sure I believe it. Because we read a book in Gutenberg by Alistair MacIntyre called After Virtue. He has a whole chapter on this where he basically argues that by its very nature, human behavior is unpredictable. And because human behavior is unpredictable, economics is unpredictable. So as much as we like, as much as we can study trends and patterns and this and that, the God of the universe, who is the only one who controls the heart of men, can always throw us a curveball. We can always be blindsided by, whoa, what's going on here? This is unprecedented. No duh. I mean, because human beings in their freedom, when fear and greed and any number of things come to play, and we know from history how a zeitgeist, a spirit, can take over a whole culture and can drive a whole culture to do things. Well, how do I know that's not going to happen? To my benefit or to my harm, one way or the other? We just don't know. So it's sort of presumptuous on our part to put ourselves in a position where we think we really know with certainty what exactly is the right the right policy. So we do the best we can. We make judgment calls. And I think I need to respect your right to make a different judgment about how best to accomplish this than I can. What God is going to look at in evaluating how I am being is, why would I want to do that? And if I'm doing it out of those motives that are the same motives that are drive the heart of God, then I'm pleasing to him, even if I'm stupid. You know, I mean, my decision may be absolutely idiotic. I'm just completely clueless about, you know, about reading history and reading society and so on and so forth. Now, the problem I have with the decisions I see and the attitudes and perspectives that I see some people taking is there's one antidote to that stupidity, and that is when we make even that judgment, let's pay attention to the biblical worldview. What does it tell us about the human heart, for example? We know that's true. So if there's this disconnect between the decisions I'm making socially and politically and my biblical worldview that tells me what the human heart is like, whereas I have a worldview that assumes the human heart is innocent, there's something desperately incoherent about that. And that's what I would hope that we would make sure that we would pay attention to the full-bodied biblical worldview and what it has to say about us, and allow that to inform our judgments about economics and social and political issues and that kind of thing as well. Because I think that's a problem.
I guess I'd like to make an observation and then have you comment on it.
Okay.
And it's a bit tangential, sorry. I've noticed in my own life and in many of the biblical characters, there's kind of a circular system that God puts in place after someone kind of repents. So, for example, Saul, when he was converted and became Paul and was knocked off his horse and gone blind, so much for free will, was then sent to Philip, was it? Where the Lord came to Philip and said, I'm sending Saul to you, and you need to lay hands on him so that he can receive his
son. Ananias was the guy's name.
Okay, Philip Ananias, you know, the same guy.
Yeah. Yeah, Philip Ananias.
Those guys, they were brothers. And the Lord's response was, yeah, but you don't know how much Paul's going to have to suffer for my sake. You look at Moses who, and so Paul was sent back to the very institution that he probably helped create, and spent the rest of his life having to interact with kind of that evil that he created. You look at Moses, who came out of the Egyptian lifestyle, was converted, and then sent back to that. And now we have Zacchaeus, who now is an honest tax collector, who will now be sent back to his compadres who are not honest, and he will kind of reap the full benefit of, you know, the full power of the Death Star, as you will. You know, it's like you're going to have to experience. You kind of talked about the evil of the world and the sorrow of the world. There's kind of, when you're redeemed and you go back into that system, there seems like there's a redemptive value of having to then interact with the world that you have created beforehand. And I guess I'd like to have your perspective about why that situation occurs. I mean, in my life, I constantly need to be reminded that I'm sinful and broken and damaged, and that's a permanent condition. So when I interact with my children who are damaged from the ways that I've been hurtful to them, I have to look at myself and go, wow, I really need to have mercy extended to me by God, because I can't, you know, and it's a way that God keeps me, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'd like kind of your perspective about just that whole system that seems to be kind of repetitive.
Well, maybe I'm not fully appreciating exactly the point you're making. I mean, even if, let's take Zacchaeus, I mean, you may raise an interesting point. Back to my point about this is not the Marxist socialist Jesus who's speaking here. He doesn't, you know, what would the Marxist socialist Christian today say to Zacchaeus? That is a stinking institution, that tax collecting. You need to get out of it and get out of it now. There's no disciple of mine can be a tax collector. He doesn't say that. Because I think Jesus knows what job you're going to take then. If you want to not be compromised, where are you going to work? Where are you going to live? Where are you going to breathe if you're not going to be compromised? We just all are compromised by the very nature of existing as human beings in this age and in this world. So you're right. We are thrown right back into this evil cesspool of a world, and now with our eyes open. So now we see the evil that we have created, and hopefully, I mean, a child of God is really going to be able to say, we have created, not you guys have created, but we have created. You know, that's why Jesus says, blessed are those who weep, for they will be comforted. I mean, this is the time to weep, because when we look at this world, everywhere you turn, people are cheating one another, they're lying to one another, they're slandering one another, they're, you know, murdering one another. Every time you turn around, we do awful things to other human beings because that's who we are. We're self-absorbed, self-protective, looking out for our best interests. At the same time that it's in this humanity that's in the image of God and can do wonderful things. It's a strange conflict that all of us display every day. So, yeah, I think you're right. Why are our eyes opened to be able and forced to go back and live here and now in the midst of this? So that we might know. So that we might know who we are and therefore know who God is, the God who's going to say, I'm not going to hold it against you. I'm going to snatch you out and take you someplace else to another existence where it will no longer be evil. It will no longer be unjust.
And do you think then the redemptive value, let's just talk about Zacchaeus, having to then rub shoulders with people that used to be the way he used to be, or the people who are the way he used to be, for Zacchaeus himself, and if we dare speak from God's perspective, what are the results of that program? What are the benefits to us? Why does God seem to, I mean, in every... person seem to kind of do that, you know, just like, okay, you created this, now I'm going to redeem you, and now I want you to interact with it the rest of your life.
Well, let me correct the way you put that in a second. It's not that they are the way Zacchaeus used to be. They are the way Zacchaeus is. I mean, I guarantee you, Zacchaeus is going to continue to get a little bit more taxes than he really ought to, and I mean, he's going to continue being evil. But now this evil Zacchaeus is doing evil, has a conscience about that, and it causes him consternation, and he can now identify with the other people faced with the pressures that they're facing, and knowing what it's like to be an evil person, and can speak to them of the mercy of God. And really, that's the same place all of us are in. I mean, that's what the world just completely doesn't understand about Christianity. The message that they think they're getting from Christians is, come to Jesus and be like me. Be good like me. Well, no, of course not. I'm not going to be any better than anybody else. I face the same pressures and the same weaknesses and the same temptations. But what I understand that they don't understand is, A, that this is damnable, being this kind of being, and that it's only by the mercy of God that any of us stand. And that's a message I can take to them. Are they going to hear it? Probably not. But there are going to be some for whom that's going to be good news. That's going to release the burden that they live their lives under. And that's really all we can do, is release that burden by declaring the good news that God's going to be merciful to us who are sinners.
I have an expansion and a challenge. Follows on Deanna's question a bit in terms of how we as believers think toward our world and make decisions about how we act toward our world. And I'm encouraged by what you've just said in that sense, that, you know, the point is more, our attitude and disposition that we, in a sense, as individuals, make over time. I'm disturbed, though, by your comment earlier that puts the Enlightenment and socialism and Marxism in one lump category, which I think you know it's not that simple. And that it upsets, and there's an implication there, and I say this with some trepidation because I don't know this community that well, that I may be a minority figure to some degree, but I think it is so critical how we as Christians not only speak to the world about how we think about, not what our point of view necessarily becomes, but what's underneath how we make our decisions, or how we even think through coming to a decision. And I think it's even perhaps all the more important that we be really careful with each other as Christians within our community about that. And it's striking to me, there was an implication as you talked about the political left. I mean, I'm someone who struggles with those issues all the time because to me there is such a huge gap between how we frame our own political worlds, whether we're Americans or people in other countries, in our present lives, but historically, and what the Bible really says. You know, the gap is just extraordinary. And historically speaking, there are so many problems on the right as there are so many problems on the left. And yet you stated that you put Enlightenment and Marxism in one box and also implied that the political left is sort of the other. And I guess I think, and so that's such something I find disturbing in the sense that I think especially as Christians in our culture today, there can be an assumption that the right is where people are. I think we just need to be so careful about how we speak of that with each other, and I'm so with you that we're so broken, and the biblical worldview is what hopefully we're all aiming at, but I don't want us to get away with each other of just making what feels like a quick, you know, I don't think that's what you think in some ways, but to me it felt like it was so quick and assumed that the left and secularism were all on one spot, and that by implication the right is, I don't think the left and right is really the way politics ultimately do fall out. I mean, I think they fall out in the way God works among us, et cetera. But right. I wonder if you could just respond, and maybe I'm making too much of it, but it concerns me when I see assumptions in there that I think we all follow up on sometimes carelessly. And
forgive me if I don't mean to be annoying by taking your words too seriously, but if you notice what you just said, to put the Bible on one hand and something in secularism on the other, I mean, surely those are worlds apart.
Or to yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
Right.
Now, I may be wrong about this, but as a relatively casual observer, but I'm not uninformed. I mean, I do kind of pay attention. It seems to me that the left is thoroughly secular.
I would say there are many. I would not say the left and secularism are the same thing. And again,
okay.
I don't want that to be I don't want this to dominate the morning discussion, but I don't think the right is fully biblical.
I didn't say that.
I don't think you're saying that, but I don't think I guess where I'm raising the caution line, and again, this is based on kind of where I'm coming from, is even tying any threads from the Bible to left and right as we human beings line out our political outline of the world. Because I have a hard time believing that the left, I guess I don't think the left is entirely secular in a way, I don't think the left is entirely contrary to a worldview to a biblical worldview in a way that the, certainly in a way that the right has better answers.
Okay. Well, I have my own judgment on that. I don't pretend to be infallible in that judgment. And I can't make that judgment out of what the Bible teaches, because the Bible's written at a time where those categories aren't even really under in play. So we don't have any biblical witness directly to sort that out for us. So we are left to have to do philosophical analysis of the underpinnings of one set of values and the underpinnings of another set of values, and then evaluate them based on how those measure up and whether or not those are coherent with the biblical worldview. Now, up to a point, I think I've done that for myself, and I have my own judgment about that. That would be a much longer discussion, and maybe that would be a discussion that we should have here. Would there be much interest in that? Okay. I'll work on that. But my main point is, we're not going to be judged by how coherent my worldview is. We're going to be judged by the orientation of my heart. So the worst thing that could happen would be if we pass judgment on each other based on our politics rather than on our heart for God.
Absolutely.
And I mean, that's my basic underlying point.
And I'm with you there, and I really do, I'm confident that's what you're saying. I guess I was concerned by, again, and we don't need to spend the morning on it, but not what political point of view you may hold, and I struggle with my own, you know, and I think, you know, we probably all do, but the sense of, I guess I'm struggling with, and maybe it is a point of disagreement, or ultimately is a point of disagreement between, for one, linking enlightenment and socialism, and the left, all as ultimately, I think, in that you put those all as one thing, and I think we just need to be more careful and more nuanced when we talk about those things, because it can invite, I think, very not very thought through ways of lumping all sorts of things together. I guess that's my concern.
Okay, my only point is that I do appreciate nuance, and I think I'm capable of nuance at times, but I don't like it. Right? I'd have to define my terms, but the reason I'm lumping them all together is what. Let me be clear. What they all have in common are two things: one, a tendency to see an optimistic view of history that's built into history itself. That's what you see coming out of the Enlightenment. That this idea, I mean, that Hegel is there, and Marx comes right on the tails of Hegel, is that built into the very fabric of history itself are the mechanisms that are going to lead us into glory, into the kingdom of God. That's an Enlightenment perspective. I would argue that's not the biblical perspective. If history ends well, it's because God scripts it as ending well, and moves it to end well, not because it's built into the mechanism of history itself. It's not inevitable. It depends on human choice, ultimately. It's not inevitable. So that's what Enlightenment, Marxism, and then the socialism that clustered around those two things, that's what they all have in common. There's a lot of nuance. I mean, there's all kinds of leftists that are not Marxists. I understand that. But there's one theme that ties them all together. The biblical worldview is we have a choice to make. And what we do in our freedom is going to drive history. That was Kierkegaard's problem with Hegel, is that you're not taking into account, we're human beings and we're free and we have choices to make. And what we decide is going to make all the difference in the world. Well, that's the biblical, I think Kierkegaard's right, that's the biblical worldview. But that's all I was trying to say. And what comes out of that Marxist, Enlightenment, socialist framework then is this emphasis on outward institutions, outward, and that comes straight out of Hegel, that the inner logic of history manifests itself in building our institutions to be the institutions that they are. Well, again, that's not the biblical worldview. They're not the products of ideas in history. They're the products of evil human beings. And so they inevitably become tainted by the evil of human beings. A very different orientation, a very different perspective on human culture than the Enlightenment perspective. That's all I was doing. I'm trying to combine some themes that do tie them together, but I do recognize that there are other themes that make all kinds of branches to the Enlightenment.
That's
project.
Kind of my comment. It's just, yeah. Again, within our current context, and perhaps with our current context of this month, or what, that the way we speak and invite implications can be pretty carries a lot of import. Maybe I'll stop there.
Well, maybe it is would be helpful. I mean, enough of you seem to be interested that maybe we'll organize some meetings where we can talk some politics, political theory in the context of looking at the Bible. I do it with a little bit of trepidation. My experience with politics, the more I've looked at it, politics is like sports. I mean, it really brings out the kind of competitive thing in you. And what I've noticed is, how do sports work? You flip a coin and you choose a team. I mean, what happens at the Super Bowl when you haven't been following the teams? You choose one because it makes it way more exciting if you have a vested interest in the outcome. So you invest somehow in the outcome, and then you watch the game with much greater interest, and you can yell and shout and celebrate and get depressed and all that kind of stuff based on what's happening there. It really becomes a visceral experience a lot of adrenaline that gets produced. It seems to me that most people do politics the same way. So they pick their candidate on a coin flip, on what's fashionable, on what's going to have social currency with their peer group, sometimes on principle, but doesn't have to be. I mean, you just pick a candidate, and then the lenses, and this happens in sports too, if you are a Duck fan, they can do no wrong. They have the best quarterback, they have the best running back, they have the best offensive line, and the fact that they didn't perform was not their fault. It was, I mean, you can make an argument, you can construct an argument for why they are so good.
Technical difficulties resulted in the loss of the remainder of this talk.